Hi there, and thank you for tuning in to Asking for a Friend. My name is Katrina Buffard, and I'm a clinical sexologist and psychotherapist. This podcast provides you with evidence-based information and real-world advice about getting to know yourself better sexually, and it covers all those topics that we would rather ask about for a friend. Just a warning, this podcast may contain conversations of a sexual nature and isn't suitable for kids. Professor Elna McIntosh is legendary in the field of sexual health in South Africa. I consider her to be a bit of a fairy godmother of sex, and one of the most experienced and knowledgeable people working in the field. Elna's a clinical sexologist, running her practice DISA Clinic in Johannesburg, with nearly 40 years' experience to her name. She's also my mentor and was originally my supervisor. But she's also someone who's beaten breast cancer twice. And so as Breast Cancer Awareness Month draws to a close, I wanted to hear from someone with professional and personal experience about a topic we don't speak much about in relation to breast cancer. Elna, thank you so much for joining me today on Asking for a Friend.
Thank you, Katriana. It's really nice to chat to you.
We have known each other a very, very long time, and you know, I tell anyone who will listen that you are the reason that I'm doing this job and doing this work. So I feel very privileged to kind of be able to feature you as one of my guests on a podcast, knowing that I wouldn't be recording this podcast and have the passion and the drive that I have if it wasn't for somebody like you.
Thank you very much. I, on the other hand, have vicariously lived through your life and just felt very proud with yet every other degree that you used to get. I think like on par with your parents. It's been such a pleasure watching your career just grow and grow. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks. And yes, eternally the academic family, it seems that we are. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and I felt that I had to do a podcast in October on a topic around breast cancer that I felt was relevant. And one of the areas of our life that doesn't just disappear because we have had a diagnosis or we're undergoing treatment or we've survived breast cancer is our sexuality. And in the time that I've been doing this work, I've been contacted by doctors, by partners, by patients to say, you know, please come and talk to us as a team of medical professionals helping women who've been diagnosed with breast cancer. Or please, can my partner and I come to see you to help us navigate how to reconnect sexually and intimately, you know, following successful treatment of breast cancer. And for me, this topic is so often overlooked. It's as if, as I said, it just goes away entirely. And I really felt that As a sexologist yourself, a clinical sexologist, and as a woman who survived breast cancer twice, I don't think there's anybody better that I could be asking for a friend about breast cancer and sex. So I wonder if you would be open to sharing a little bit of your own story of how this has affected you.
So I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 36. And now I am 60 plus. In fact, I'm 62 years old now. And when I was first diagnosed, I really just thought, please let me just get to 40. I need to get my child through school. It was so you're almost just in survival mode when you are first diagnosed. And I think everybody goes into that mode from the doctors, just concentrate on your treatment. And you know, once you've lost your hair, you've lost your breast or breasts, a lot of things happen to you. That you actually look at yourself in the mirror and first of all, you can't look at yourself in the mirror because you just feel distraught, disgusted. I can't even really think of the words back then.
Like almost unwomanly, maybe.
A lot of those things of who would ever love me? Will my lover stay, leave? A lot of women feel that the men will leave them. Mm-hmm. And often, so if I put my professional hat on, often when I do see a patient who says, my husband left me, I'm saying, you know, he was probably going to leave you anyway. Mm. So it's not necessarily, if he just loved you for your breasts, we're better off. I wouldn't say that in a first session, but as we work, yeah. as we work around as things.
Go along.
But and yeah, so then I just went on with my life, and life carried on. And then my breast cancer returned at age 48, and that actually hit me. It was almost like I just sailed through the first lot. Maybe just put it behind me in a way, just ignored it. So at age 48, it was far more real for me. And the treatment was also very different. And at 48, I wasn't in menopause yet, but they push you into menopause with all the treatment. So a lot of other things also happen. So I think a lot has to do with age when it happens to you. And as we now see very young women, you know, we see women that are young women that are 18, 19, in their 20s. So a lot what stage of life you are at, because for women that have not had children, we have to have a very different conversation with them. Like, bank your eggs. You know, you might be 18 and not think of motherhood, but who knows? Because once you have your chemo or your radiation, motherhood's not going to be an option.
But you might not even be able to do that, because the fertilization process of the eggs may aggravate the cancer as well. And I know that's in you know, extreme cases, but yeah. Mm. So the question of motherhood gets called into it, doesn't it?
So it's so my story really just now, yearly October, make me very aware of, oh, it's breast cancer month and it's time to book your next mammogram, but not in October. So I usually go in my birthday month. In my birthday month, which is July, I do all my tests and all my things that have to be done. And that is, if there's one advice I can give to somebody, whether you come from a history of cancer or not, if you have a family history of cancer, at age 30, 35, you start your sonars. Otherwise, at age 40, you start your mammograms. But early detection is absolutely, and I think that's what I often say, I'm still alive because of early detection.
Yeah.
Because you have to do your tests. But I must tell you, something happened now. I also got COVID. I feel like I'm a super duper survivor.
You are a super duper survivor.
Two breast cancers and COVID. But there is a lot of similarities almost between COVID and any terminal condition. Cancer had a lot of stigma way back in the days. But nowadays it's very acceptable. But with COVID, it really carries stigma and shame. But why I'm comparing the two for myself is, I was waiting for my results, my COVID results came at 2 a.m. in the morning, and it came to me directly because we tested under my name. And I sat till the sun came up before I decided I must phone somebody about this. And it's that agony of waiting for your results. So I think for anybody going just through testing, whether you're going to test positive or negative, the relief and all those things, but breast cancer for a lot of people it is like a death sentence, and frankly it's not. So that's my story.
I think, you know, your survivorship is quite phenomenal. I'm hoping for eternal immortality for you, but I know you probably don't want that. You know, in your clinical training, you know, you trained in the States, and I like to think of you as the godmother of sex in South Africa, because you came back and brought all of these skills and expertise back to South Africa for you, for everybody else. And you've spent your career teaching others, mentoring others like myself, supporting patients, helping couples and individuals. And in your training, were you ever given any training on sex and cancers, and how to help your future patients in this regard?
So I worked in two different states. So I was with Dr. Dumina Renshaw at the Jesuit Catholic Medical School Loyola, where there were a very big focus on couples therapy, and everything was around couples. And then in San Francisco, where anything just went, at the Institute, we probably spent more time looking at under the heading of disability, but cancers would fall under disability. And we spend a tremendous amount of time. And one would have thought that at a medical school, we would have spent more time around all sorts of cancers, male cancers, female cancers, but we didn't. We didn't. We focused on relationships there. And in California, where we were exposed to a lot of things, I had brilliant training around all the cancers, not just breast cancer. But yeah, I felt I came back with very good education around that.
That's so fantastic to hear. Because one of the things I hear from medical professionals in South Africa, including oncologists, is that there is very little training around sexuality and sexual health. So while you were a sexual health professional being trained with oncological knowledge, the oncological professionals are not being trained with any sexual health knowledge. Is that your experience as well?
Yes, again, I think oncologists are trained to just focus on getting people better, or otherwise, if it is end stage, to make people's lives as comfortable, or just to withdraw any treatment. So, I mean, some of the oncology centers actually do employ social workers or psychologists. I mean, you have a close link with one of the groups as well.
Yes.
Because there's multidisciplinary groups. I think nowadays people are far more aware of pull everybody in, you know, from the dietitian to the plastic surgeon to everybody. So, and I form part of a breast cancer group. So I'm sometimes amazed the input from all the different professions. But I think often people also hide behind, well, I'm the surgeon, this is my job, I'm the dietitian, I'm just going to focus on food. You know, sometimes it overlaps.
Mm.
I think all disciplines should be trained in it, from the physiotherapist to the radiologist to everybody, because yeah. We do such intimate work, you know.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, If a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer and she successfully undergoes treatment and she's a breast cancer survivor like yourself, what are some of the impacts that process physiologically and psychologically would have on a woman's sexual response?
So for me, once you've been through the treatment and your hair's back or your hair's still coming back, or It is about self-love, self-care, and actually making peace with your body. Because if you can't accept your own body, you can't expect somebody else. If you must always apologize to your body as well. I usually say to people, come with a list of questions you want to ask me. And then I can go through and ask whatever weird and bizarre you think. Because maybe sometimes we just have to explain physiology, never mind anatomy, but physiology to people about the sexual response cycle.
Mm.
Because women's bodies are put into menopause from the medication that they're getting. A lot of women are put on tamoxifen for 5 years, which does a lot of body changes. And just if you have got a 25 or 30-year-old patient who's suddenly put into menopause, you know what, I'm in my 60s now, I've been through menopause, I kind of know I make peace with my fat stomach and whatever. But if you are young and vibrant and suddenly your body is not your own body anymore, and you've got to talk to them about lubricants, and she's never in her life had to even think about lubricating. She just naturally lubricated. And now suddenly she's got to go out and buy. And people are embarrassed and they don't know what to buy. And they, you know, they can go into a big pharmacy. And, you know, it's very confusing. So I think people just grab the first thing that they can get. And because your mucosa, your mouth, if you think of it, your vagina and your mouth are so similar. It's mucous membranes. When you're having chemo and radiation, you get ulcers in your mouth. You get ulcers in your vagina. Sex becomes painful. And often people think, oh, can I even ask my doctor about these things? Patients are often so relieved when I just say, have you got ulcers in your mouth? You probably have them in your vagina as well. And they, I thought I had an STD. So sometimes it's far more of an educational session in the beginning, you know, before it's actually a therapeutic session that you have with patients. And I always encourage partners to come with, whether it's a same-sex couple or a heterosexual couple, bring, come along. Let's talk. Men are also often scared they're going to hurt their wives. Mm. Even after surgery, she might have perfect breasts now. They're just so lovely. And he doesn't even want to look at them because he's just scared he might damage them. So I think sometimes we just got to also encourage, not encourage, wrong word, maybe just put their minds at ease.
Normalize their experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting. You're mentioning all of the, you know, some of the different things that could happen. And I guess no two women's experience is the same in how it can affect them, from the way that they view their body to how their partner views their body, their relationship they have to their breasts and their partner's relationship to that, to vaginal dryness and the fact that you don't naturally get lubricated anymore. The psychological as well as the physiological changes are quite big. And what about anatomical changes? Is there a kind of shrinking of any of the tissue, like in the small lips of the vulva?
It can happen as well. Again, it depends on what treatment. You know, some people just have surgery because it was maybe a stage one. But some people have advanced cancer already, so they need far more drastic treatment, aggressive treatment. But we see atrophy because we put people in early men, we put women in early menopause, you know, for a duration of the period, and then we stop. I think that's also another thing for young women, because we stop their periods. So menstruation often for a young one is important. And speaking of that, contraception. That's often not a discussion that's had with women. Now, if you can't be on a hormonal contraceptive anymore, so your choices are extremely limited, especially after your treatment is finished. So it's very difficult for people in long-term relationships to say you have to use condoms. You have two options, condoms or a copper IUD. So there's so many discussions that are around health, medicine. It's quite clinical discussions one has to have with a patient. And often they just need, I call them the feely-touchy talks as well. The importance of just, you know, sex is very overrated, Catriona. You know that. What did you sometimes the weekend, twice on the weekends. I mean, there's no right or wrong.
There isn't.
And people just touching. It's that, I mean, we go on about touch, but I can't emphasize it enough, the importance of touch. You know, if somebody's just had a big surgery and in the beginning, there's no expectations of her to be having sex. I mean, it's so personal and it varies from couple to couple, but I often just say to them, you know what, just take a break. Just get used to all the medication. Because if you're on chemo, I mean, you are vomiting and tired and a lot of things happen. Mm-hmm. But if you're not having chemo, you're having radiation, you don't necessarily have the nausea, but you have more of a tiredness. So maybe go to bed early and have sex in the morning. You know, sometimes we just have to give very practical advice to patients. And if possible, encourage a partner or get somebody else to Google. I always say that. Please don't go Google yourself. Give your husband that job. Because it is so scary. And if you Google, you're just going to get very, very medical things and then you die anyway. Because, you know, with Google, you always die.
Yes, yes, you always die according to
you get this, the worst that can be. The worst is death. And I think it is so important to encourage. And that's why when I do talk to people, you know, I've lived a very long and full life and did more things. I only went back to do my PhD after a cancer diagnosis. And I think that's important. Rediscover yourself. Cut those people out that drain you. You know, those ones that come to tell you about their auntie that also died from breast cancer and her daughter, and you just think, please, you know, there's certain things that we don't need to hear. But yeah. Sometimes, and that would be practical advice for friends or whoever.
I think it's so interesting that in so many of these interviews that I'm doing for this podcast, the concept of permission comes up in almost every single discussion I've had so far, and I'm sure will continue to. And you and I know, as sexologists, that permission is paramount to the work that we do. And I don't think it's any different here in the context of breast cancer, because what you've just said is, you know, you work to give couples the permission not to have sex if they're feeling a certain way, or to have sex in the morning, not at night. And a lot of the stuff you've been saying is around expectations that the woman or the couple may have, and about leveling out those expectations, bringing those expectations closer to reality, but also telling them, hey, it's okay if you don't feel like sex. You don't have to feel like sex right now. You know, and when you have kind of survived this, and when you are learning, you know, to reconnect with yourself in different ways, and you're recognizing what's important to you in life, what type of sexual relationship is important to you, and what does that look like? I think if we look at touch is crucial to us as human beings, both physically and psychologically. We know that from, you know, the plethora of studies we see out there, from, you know, the 1950s on orphans in Romania to nowadays looking at the effects of touch during a global pandemic and the lack of touch. And yeah. I think that something that often happens is that so much pressure is placed on a couple to have sexual intercourse that the feelings of inadequacy are very common. Now, that's on top of the feelings of inadequacy a woman who's survived breast cancer may already be feeling about her body, about being a woman, femininity. And I think that a lot of the time when I'm seeing clients who have survived breast cancer, there's almost a need to help them, I wouldn't even say relearn, but, you know, start a new sexual template of what their connection sexually is going to look like.
So I still like a non-implicit model.
Yes.
Where P stands for permission, and then LI for limited information, because we can't throw them with all the textbooks. We give them the necessary information. S is for specific suggestions, and so that would be, you know, use a water-based lubricant, or there's such a great range if you just look on My Sexual Health what they can get online. And then the IT stands for intensive therapy. But if we actually do the PLIS part well, the therapy, it actually doesn't have to be intensive therapy.
Yeah,
it sometimes just needs a few sessions and maybe a follow-up again, you know, when she is better, or later on, or checking in again later. But my mentor, and I still love her to bits, and she is no more, Professor Domina Renshaw, her four T's, which is time, trust, talk, and touch. And so the T again for touch, so important. And the time. Timing has actually got a lot to do with it as well. You know, if you've just had chemo, it hits you 2 and 3 days later. So that's not maybe really the time to be talking 2 and 3 days later. Get over that again, or as we go forward. But the time, we need to make that time. Just as we talk about date, the night, and these things, make that time. And the trust part, because often women become paranoid and they don't trust their husband anymore, or their partner is going to leave me. I think he's having an affair, because if you're in recovery, you often have so much time that, okay, nowadays you've got Netflix and fabulous other things to watch. But if you're just sitting there and you were working before, and suddenly you've just got all this time at home. I remember I used to watch that channel where you can buy things. You know, what is that channel called? Very Mark Channel. Very Mark, that one. Then I used to watch this channel, because, I mean, it's many years ago. And then I think, I won't be able to live without one of these whatever stupid things, and I must buy now, I must call them now. So sometimes we become hyper-focused on really silly things. So maybe it is time to just find other interests, other things, and keep our minds busy so that we don't become paranoid about this man might leave me, this woman might leave me.
Mm. I think trust is such an important one, isn't it? Because you're also having to learn to trust your body again as a woman.
And this body just failed you. You're very disappointed in this body of yours.
Okay.
And I also think the role that your breasts played in your life. And that's because some women are so flat-chested that it's never been a big deal. But somebody who's got who's like a D or an E or sometimes a G cup, can you imagine having a mastectomy and then you'd be off balance? I mean, nowadays we have modern medicine with amazing surgeons. We are blessed in this country. So even in our government sector, if we look at Helen Joseph with the plastic surgeon, the breast surgeon, Professor Carol Ann Benn, where the same person that you'll see in private practice, you'll see in the government hospital as well. So they are amazing. And around the country, there's more and more breast units. And if I look at Pink Drive, for instance, they go around the country with their big pink trucks, and there's mammograms available for women. Now over lockdown, they went to the Northern Cape, they were in KZN, now they're in Limpopo this coming week. And there's the services that are there for women, and we must encourage people to make use of it. It's a free service.
And as you said earlier, you know, early detection is so important. I wonder if we can maybe look at the couple who are now having to navigate their sexual connection following a kind of surviving breast cancer, beating breast cancer. You know, you mentioned touch as being so important, and using that PLICIT model as we do in our therapy, where permission, limited information, and specific suggestions are just, you know, if we can do that, it can sometimes be enough. But what would be perhaps some of the more specific suggestions you would give to a couple who were trying to navigate reconnecting sexually after beating this cancer diagnosis?
So often people aren't realistic. You know, a lot of people always read the Durek Sex Survey of the year, and then it says this country has sex 365 days a year, and so it carries on. We have to, I think, give realistic expectations to people as well. Loss of libido affects, well, in my practice, 60% of patients that come to me come because of loss of libido, and they haven't had breast cancer. So, I mean, apart from the breast cancer ones that do come. So you'll also go through the normal stages of any relationship. And loss of libido can be for so many other reasons without being ill. So to be realistic, if she is not feeling like sex, to say, and again, to normalize it for her, but what else is happening? It is important. And then again, what happened in their sex life before? Because often, once people have come for therapy, their sex lives improve, because for the first time, they are actually allowed to talk about things. And maybe the woman now admits she's never had an orgasm in her life. So now, post-breast cancer, she's actually learning new things. And for me, it's so important that it's almost like rediscovering. It's almost like having new lovers. This is my new lover. It's new things.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I think there is that level of anxiety, of course, that new lovers may have. There's, of course, a level of a different kind of anxiety that would be present there. But it's about, as I like to look at it, like writing a new sexual template, writing a new sexual blueprint that you can use that is maybe, you know, starting off softer and more slowly and more with touch than this passionate, lustful, you know, kind of sexual interaction that a lot of couples have in the early stages of their relationship.
Yeah.
It's really about slowing things down. And I know that we would suggest that whether you've beaten breast cancer or not, one of the techniques we suggest is sensate focus, which focuses so much on touch and on the different erogenous zones of the body, and erogenous zones being kind of any area of the body that's heightened to sexual stimulation. But I think something that's very important to say then is, with focusing on different areas of the body and the breasts and nipples being an erogenous zone, there's also perhaps the real need to communicate with your partner around how you're feeling about that part of your body. Maybe wearing, a beautiful, silky, nice feeling top just to cover your breasts when you first start engaging in kind of any sexual encounters with your partner again, or having the lights off if that helps you feel more comfortable, or asking your partner not to touch your chest and your stomach or your shoulders if those are areas anywhere around the breast or the nipples that make you feel uncomfortable. I think that giving permission to the couple when the partner's there can make such a difference to her level of comfort, because very often I think we can have the woman alone in our office and she has to go home to her partner and kind of relay what it is that we've said. But when it comes directly from us rather than through the messenger, it's kind of like, yeah, the doctor says so, right? So that's a no from me. You will not be engaging in any sexual intercourse yet. We're going to get you back there gradually and slowly and one step at a time until you're feeling comfortable with it again.
You know, some of the obstacles that I have is the single woman or the divorced woman,
yeah,
who suddenly have to literally start with, you're finding a new lover, but like with your husband. But now you are starting off, and a lot of women say, I don't know how. How am I actually going to tell this man that, you know, what you see is not what you're going to get? And so that is always an interesting discussion for me to have with my single ladies, because you've got to give them a lot of confidence, whatever. And you know what, again, if he's going to leave, he's going to leave. But a lot of men, and sometimes they bring the partner with and we work through it together, the new partner. And then often these men go, she's so brave. She's a warrior. You know, they come up with these wonderful, you know, I love her more now than I know these things. And so I think that often if it's a new relationship, it's one of those things that you've got to get out the way, because it's sooner or later you're going to be intimate. And you don't want to just shout surprise. Nowadays, well, pull up your top and go surprise. But I must say, nowadays, the surgeons do nipple sparing. You know, for a lot of women, the fact that they lost their nipples, you know, they're okay with they've got these reconstructed breasts. But and there's these fantastic tattoo artists that make 3D nipples. You know, yes, there's no feeling, but the woman feels better. But they also do nipple sparing surgery nowadays versus a radical mastectomy in the old days. Though sometimes it's necessary and they still do them. But often women say to me, my breasts look much better now than what they looked before. A lot of women are so proud. They can't wait to show me their breasts. I love it. You know, you see the confidence in these women. The other thing is it is almost a wake-up call, and like you smelling the roses of, you know, that one is an oxygen thief, and I'm going to end my friendship relationship with so-and-so because you almost start taking more, you're aware of every hour counts for me, every day is precious, and I must, you know, be positive and spend my time with positive people. But saying that, for some people, the depression is so deep and so deeply set, and often they were depressed even before the surgery. And on that point, it is very important that you be honest with your doctor what medication you are on. Because sometimes you're with a psychiatrist and a breast surgeon, and the psychiatrist are giving you Zoloft or Paxil or Valium, and that tamoxifen doesn't like that. So drug interactions. So The one is not, you know, you can have an antidepressant, but it's not working against your tamoxifen. Otherwise, tamoxifen isn't going to work. Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, you're making perfect sense. And I think, again, it's the importance of being able to ask these questions of your healthcare providers, and, you know, or the healthcare providers asking these questions, so that, you know, sometimes the patient may feel very embarrassed or ashamed to admit that they're on antidepressants, or they've actually never had a desire for sex, you know, some long before they were diagnosed with breast cancer. So, you know, it's again, permission, being given permission to explore these topics, or feeling that they have the permission to ask these questions. But you know, you made such a good point about women who aren't in relationships, who are divorced, who are single, and their experience of their sexuality once they've beat breast cancer. Because I think that I imagine that there's a real added level of anxiety there of what is it going to be like when, and perhaps an added level of pressure. And I think I've heard, unfortunately, too often where a woman who's been, you know, in her 40s or 50s and has beaten breast cancer, but has just made the decision to be on her own and not have any sexual relationships because she, you know, according to her, is not perhaps, you know, interested in that. But when you dig a little deeper, you find out that there's an immense fear there, or an immense shame there, or who would want me, or who would like me. So I think that that was such a relevant and interesting point. And then the other point you made about, you know, being able to have, you know, better looking breasts perhaps, or, you know, have a better relationship to your breasts perhaps than you did before you were diagnosed. You know, I've seen the work of a tattooist in Cape Town, Honey Fowler, who she does the most incredible 3D tattoos. And I could not tell the difference between a real nipple and her 3D tattooed nipple that she had done on a woman. And she did incredible work, and I'll definitely have her on the podcast, I think, in the future. But, you know, to empower women again in their bodies and help them to feel better in their bodies. And I think that, you know, if we think about plastic surgery, if somebody doesn't like their nose or their breasts or their bum, you know, they're able to go and have something done about it with a plastic surgeon if they wanted to. They could afford that, and if it was an option. But, you know, when we're overcoming something like breast cancer, if our body has been affected, you are able to take steps, if you can, to, you know, feel better about your body again, both psychologically, but also through things like having your nipples tattooed, having, you know, buying lingerie that makes you feel good, reconnecting with different parts of yourself. What about if we were to talk, or can we talk just briefly about how women who are single can kind of explore their sexuality on their own after surviving? I mean, is there anything specific or practical we can talk about a woman who doesn't have a partner that she can do?
So in South Africa, we are blessed with Desire, a great website. You can go online. But you know, it's not even always about sex stories. Some women are also turned on by erotic literature. I think it's very important that we keep the old brain ticking over as well, because as women, we like to read. You know, we started off reading Mills and Boone when we were 16 and 17, and so it moved on. And there's a lot of great writers. And then just by yourself, watch an erotic movie. Self-pleasuring, so important. And if you feel uncomfortable with masturbation on yourself, maybe just touching yourself in massaging, rubbing, finding pleasure, going to a spa where somebody else is touching you, not in a sexual way, just in a touch way.
And actually, touch, coming back to it, is so important, and it doesn't always have to be a sexual touch. It can just be a soothing touch. But you also touched on the fact that the brain, the brain plays the biggest role in our response to anything sexual. And the brain is not necessarily an organ, you know, once you've beaten breast cancer, is not an organ that's affected, and is, because it's our biggest sex organ, we need to continue to engage it. And, you know, what was Mills and Boone in, you know, many, many years ago is now like a fantastic app like Dipsy, which is a an app with erotic audio, and has the most wonderful, well-acted stories, realistic stories of all different ranges and topics that tell a story for kind of 10, 15 minutes and then kind of gently stop and let you and your imagination continue the rest of the story. Just being able to listen to something like that and engaging your brain sexually, even if you're not touching yourself, even if you're not using a toy, is just bringing pleasure into your mind and subjective arousal. That, I think, is something that is a really good idea for anybody just wanting to slowly get back into responding sexually, experiencing the thoughts of sex, the erotic thoughts of sex.
That's why I love listening to you, and I read and I stalk you. You know I stalk you. I stalk you on Instagram because I learn so much from you. You know, you are it's a whole new generation of things that is out there that I'm just like, this is too confusing for me. You know, so this is what we need. We need another 100 Catrionas in this country.
Thanks, you know, Alma.
People are hungry for factual information.
No, they really are. They really, truly are. But Elna, we've got to end off the episode. I could talk to you, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time, and we both can talk until the cows come home. But the last question that I want to ask you, that I ask all my guests at the end of each episode, is what has been the most surprising thing that you have learned since, you know, surviving breast cancer twice, but also working with women who are navigating their sexuality once overcoming and beating breast cancer?
So the most surprising thing was for me, the amount of women that actually have breast cancer. I mean, our statistics are, it's the second highest breast cancer in the world. Ugh, the second highest cancer. But how women just don't go for their tests, but for a number of reasons as well. But what has surprised me, and I think I've surprised myself, is that for somebody who thought I wasn't going to make 40, we're now thinking of my 70th birthday, well, maybe first my 65th birthday party. You know, I've surprised myself that I've lived this long. So I just celebrate every day. I'm happy to wake up. I'm blessed. That's really what I can say. I have amazing friends, unbelievable colleagues. And, yeah, well, life is good.
I feel that that is an important message, because if you're saying the thing that surprised me the most is how many women are diagnosed with breast cancer or ignore the lump that they feel or don't go and have their annual mammogram or annual checkup. And that includes pap smear, if they can have a pap smear, if they're able to do that. And you know, an annual breast check. There's such a clear need for women to be taking more responsibility for themselves, because you wouldn't be with us if it wasn't for early detection and for you taking responsibility for your own health. So, and I'm very grateful for that. I really am. So, Alna, where can people find you if they want to talk to you, if they want to ask you a question, if they want to engage with you on social media? I know that, as you were mentioning, you know, I'm on Instagram and posting quite a lot, but where can people find you on social media to reach out to you?
So I've got DISA Clinic, which is the name of our clinic. But I think all of us are part of My Sexual Health. So yes. I always say to everybody, just go and look. You don't have to look for me. There's lots of us on that mysexualhealth.co.za. I'm so proud to be part of that, even though I'm the granny there. But it's, you know, I feel I'm surrounded by like just all this knowledge. Hey, there's like now a lot of us on that website. Beautiful. Yeah. So much information. Everything in a nutshell.
I don't think you're the granny. You're the prof, you know. You are
the prof.
You are the prof. And you know what? I feel particularly chuffed because my picture sits next to yours on the website. So if my sexual health is going to deem me as being in line with you, then you know what? I've done something right in life. I've loved speaking to you. Thank you for sharing your personal story and your professional experiences with me and my listeners today. And to many, many, many more years of mentoring students and helping clients, you know, couples and individuals to overcome sexual difficulties.
Thank you. Thank you. This was lovely. I enjoyed talking to you today.
Me too. Got a question you'd like to ask for a friend? Reach out to me via my website or Instagram, and I'll be sure to include it in a Q&A episode soon. You can subscribe and follow this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review it.